Welcome to today's edition of Centered, a reasonable conversation about life and faith with your host, Dr. Don Belenis, PhD.
One of the most prominent subjects of debate in the United States today is immigration, and more specifically, the problem of illegal immigration. People get all bent out of shape about this issue, and just about everyone has an opinion. Well, there are at least two problems with that. First, there's so much loud argumentation about it that it's becoming more and more difficult to separate fact from fiction. And second, most opinions are based on shallow knowledge, if any knowledge at all. And I would include most of our lawmakers. By the way, experienced marriage counselors will tell you that when husbands and wives argue, it's usually the louder of the two who's more in the wrong, and probably losing the argument. Keep that in mind when you watch the usual discussions on televised news programs. However, we have an obligation, it seems to me, to discuss the immigration issue reasonably and responsibly, seeking neither to oversimplify nor overcomplicate, and we must never demonize those who seem to be on the opposite side. As with most national problems, actual solutions are difficult, requiring determination and courage, but first we must listen to one another. It's certainly not as simple an issue as some people are quick to suggest, and we're not going to argue about it here. More importantly, we are going to examine illegal immigration from a legal, social, economic, and moral standpoint. What positions and actions are really appropriate in this connection for people of faith? Before we begin, by the way, please remember that if you'd like to comment on this or any topic we take up on Centered, you can email me at dgb@centeredonline.org. Our guest today is a Board of Immigration Appeals accredited immigration counselor and a church engagement representative at World Relief DuPage in Wheaton, Illinois. He's not only done his legal homework, he's engaged the challenge of immigration up close and personal as a committed Christian. His name is Matthew Sorens, and along with his colleague, Jenny Huang, he wrote, "Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate." Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
How did the immigration debate become the center of your work?
Yeah, you know, I'm not necessarily a likely suspect to be so involved in immigration. My immigrant ancestors came to the United States many, many years ago, like the mid-1900s, so it's not something that was close to my history. And where I grew up in Wisconsin, you know, I'm sure there were immigrants around, but I didn't know any of those immigrants, and it wasn't an issue that I thought a lot about. If I thought about it at all, it was probably from what I heard on the television and what I heard on the radio. But when I was in college, I went to do some kind of a volunteering missions work down in Costa Rica, and I was working mostly with Nicaraguan migrants, and that really began me thinking about immigration, because these Nicaraguans living in Costa Rica weren't treated particularly well, and some of them had legal status, some did not, but they were there because they could get a job in Costa Rica, and they could support their families. As I got to know them, I realized there was a lot of similarities to the immigration situation in the United States. So as I came back to the U.S. and was living in the Chicago area, I decided to move into a neighborhood where most of my neighbors are immigrants from many different countries, and with, you know, many with legal status, but also many without.
So you did that very intentionally.
Yeah, very intentionally, because I really wanted to figure out, what does it mean to love my neighbor when literally this is my neighbor? And, you know, that brought me into the legal questions as well, and my work at World Relief as a legal counselor got me more acquainted than anyone should be with U.S. immigration law, which is it's an important topic. It's not necessarily a fun thing to figure out.
And so how did you and your co-author come to write this book then?
Yeah, well, you know, World Relief is we're the compassionate service arm of the National Association of Evangelicals. So we have relationships with lots of evangelical churches, and we start to get calls, especially as immigration was, you know, a hot topic 3 or 4 years ago in Congress, where a church would want us to discuss immigration at a Sunday school class or that sort of thing. And I naively volunteered to do so, and, you know, started to use the journey that I'd been through personally in trying to think about this biblically and understand how the situation is working right now. I'd bring that to churches, and I found that churches were really interested, and they'd ask me for more resources, and I didn't have much else to offer them. And at the time, there weren't any books that I was aware of from an evangelical perspective on this immigration issue. There's a few out there now in addition to the one that we've co-written, but that's where the idea for the book grew out of, really out of those church presentations and Sunday school classes.
Mm-hmm. So need for material? Write some. Good. Yeah. Now, the mass media are filled with inflammatory references to what's called the immigration debate, one of the hottest political potatoes right now. What's the key, in your view, to rational debate in this arena?
Yeah, I mean, I get very frustrated watching television or listening to the radio because it's these 30-second screaming matches back and forth with, you know, you're an idiot, you're a racist, and no one actually talks about actual policy or what's happening. I think one of the keys to, you know, finding a rational common ground is to, first of all, to recognize what we're talking about, understand how the current immigration system works, which so few people have ever had to understand because they're not immigrants, and then to recognize that there's actually a lot more commonality. I mean, very few liberal Democrats actually think we should just give legal status to everyone, and very few conservative Republicans think that we should deport everyone. There's actually a lot more common ground than people think. And then some of it is we need to define some of our terms, because people will throw around terms like amnesty, and that can be a conversation ender, because most people are against amnesty when defined the way that most people define amnesty, but some people will use the word to mean something rather different, and that's where I think
yes.
we get confused.
Yes, sure. Immigration is, of course, at least a legal issue and a social issue and a moral issue. How would you relate the three?
Yeah, well, it is a legal issue, and it has to be a legal issue inherently, because while there may be some policy issues that, you know, the church can speak into and maybe have an alternate, you know, way of discussing the issue, only the government can decide who is going to and who is not going to be allowed into the United States or into any country. So it has to be a legal issue. But it is also an important social issue, and I think that's where a lot of churches enter into this, because immigrants, of course, are people. They're human beings made in God's image, and they happen to be, in many cases, rather vulnerable people in our society. So churches that are, you know, oriented because of what God has called us to be towards caring for the vulnerable end up interacting with immigrant communities. And I think the moral issue really brings those two ideas together. Our faith calls us to be hospitable. It also calls us to follow the law. And I think as we wrestle with this as a moral issue, and specifically for believers, it's a Christian issue, it helps us try to figure out how can we, you know, are those ideas necessarily at odds with one another, or is there a way that we could both be hospitable and uphold the law? And I think that there are ways to do that. So I think that we need to bring those three parts of the issue together.
Well, how, for example, would you bring the justice and mercy that we as Christians are called upon to carry out? How would you bring those together in this issue?
Yeah, what I've supported and what World Relief has supported, what the National Association of Evangelicals has supported, it's what we call comprehensive immigration reform. And what we mean by that is, very basically, we think it should be more difficult to enter the country illegally. We don't think illegal immigration is a good thing, either for our society or for the rule of law or for immigrants, actually, because it's very dangerous to enter this country illegally. So we think we should do more to secure our borders. And we should also address the reason that people come here illegally, which is to work. And if we're not willing to make it more difficult to work illegally, if there's always going to be a help wanted sign next to the no trespassing sign, we're always going to have this problem. So we think we need to make it more difficult to enter and to work illegally. You know, the Social Security card that I have, which looks like it was made with blue construction paper and a typewriter,
mm-hmm.
is not the most secure document we could come up with.
Mm-hmm.
But that part of making it more difficult to work and to enter illegally only works if we make it more easy to enter and work in this country lawfully to meet the needs of the U.S. economy. So that's not to say open borders, but it is saying that we should have a functional visa system that is tied to the needs of the market economy. So if there are jobs available, we should have visas available for those jobs. One of the major misconceptions that people have is that those visas are already out there, and they're not. The limit for low-skilled worker visas under the Immigration and Nationality Act is 10,000 visas per year for low-skilled workers, and some of those compete with highly skilled workers for those same numbers, so that, you know, the lines for those low-skilled workers practically extend into infinity. So that's one thing we need to do, both at the low-skill level and also at the high-skill level, wherever there's a need in the economy. And then we also, because people are people and they're not just cogs in an economy, we need to keep families together as well. So if we allow someone to come in on a worker visa, we should let their wife or their husband and their children come in as well. And there's a lot of people right now stuck in backlogs. So people who've been waiting 5, 10, some cases up to 20 years to be reunited with family members under current law. So those we should clear out quickly. And then the last piece, and probably the most controversial, is, well, what do we do with the people already here?
Yes.
And what I believe is, you know, we could deport everyone, but I think that would be extremely costly, estimates are that would cost $200 billion just to physically remove everyone from the country, and then to say nothing of the economic costs of not having those people in the country as workers and as consumers. And you have a lot of, you know, you're splitting up a lot of families with U.S. citizen kids, U.S. citizen spouses who have relatives without legal status. So I don't think that's a good option. I also don't think amnesty is a good option. If we define amnesty as it's defined in the dictionary, which is, you know, unconditional grace and forgiveness, where we say, well, you're here and you broke the law, but we're just going to ignore that fact. Here's your citizenship. I think, while on a theological level, I'm a big fan of amnesty because, like I said, it's grace and I depend on that. As a matter of policy, I don't think it's what we should do because it sends the wrong message. It says that the law is not important. But what we think we could do is a middle ground that says, if you're here unlawfully, we're going to require you and allow you to come forward and register with the government. And that require or allow is a semantic difference because every single undocumented immigrant I know will be the first in line to register with the government. You know, you undergo a criminal background check. Those who have committed serious crimes would have to be deported. But for the vast majority who have just wanted to be here to work and support their families, they're going to have to pay a fine because they did break the law, so there's a penalty, and that's why it's not amnesty. And then they get into a long-term process towards permanent legal status and eventually towards citizenship and integration. And I think that's so important because we want people to continue to become part of the American society, not to be a separate class of people who are off in their own world, but to become part of what it is to be an American.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that very thing, all of us are, with the exception of the first Americans, that is, Indians. We are an immigrant nation with just relative few exceptions, but the pattern that built this country was, to a very significant degree, assimilation, as you described, learning and using English, adopting American social customs, and so forth. For some, that pattern seems to have been replaced by an insistence on separation, flying the flags of other countries, or demanding that the U.S. become a multilingual society, and so on. The melting pot was flawed, but so also is, in my opinion, strident multiculturalism. Is there not a better way?
You know, I think that the best model is one of integration, where people do take on what it is to be an American. That doesn't necessarily mean leaving behind every part of your culture.
I mean, absolutely.
We both share a Dutch culture that, even though my ancestors came here 150 or 160 years ago, is still something that I'm, you know, it's part of my identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's great. And there's certain foods that I eat in my family and certain decorations in my house that are from where I came, where my ancestors came from. But I think it is extremely important that immigrants integrate into what it is to be in America. And in my experience, most immigrants want to do that. But it's also challenging, especially the language piece, especially in the first generation. The statistics suggest that the second generation of immigrants, almost across the board, speaks English very well, and sometimes does not speak any other language, or does not speak it well. That's my experience in the neighborhood where I live. I stumble through speaking Spanish, and I'll try to practice Spanish sometimes with some of my Mexican neighbors, and the parents are, you know, thrilled to meet a North American who speaks Spanish. The kids talk back to me in English, and that's the language that they speak to their friends in. That's the language they speak in. And that's as it should be, although I think it's wonderful if they can be bilingual.
Sure.
And keep up another language as well. But I think it's also true that, you know, we sometimes romanticize the way that things, that, you know, we romanticize our American history of immigration. Even from the very beginning of the United States, there were people who were concerned that these immigrants are not assimilating.
Yes.
In fact, you know, Benjamin Franklin said some things back, you know, before this was an independent country, that sounded a lot like what you could hear certain people on the radio or television saying today, that, you know, these immigrants, they're never going to learn our language and our manners. And he said, why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to change us instead of our Anglifying them, and will never adopt our language or customs any more than they can acquire our complexion. Now, I could not tell you what the difference in complexion is between a German person and a British person, but that was Mr. Franklin's concern. But of course, you know, the Germans did integrate into society, and then the Italians did, and the Irish did, and every group of immigrants have integrated. And I think we're seeing that, but it takes a little bit of time.
Yeah. And people's perceptions, especially these days, I think, particularly their perception of undocumented, or as some would say, illegal immigrants, seems to be determined to a degree by where they live, does it not? I mean, the perspective of people who live in El Paso, Texas, is going to be quite different from the people who live in Port Huron, Michigan, on the border with Canada. And what should bring them together, in your view?
Yeah, I think that there are definitely geographic differences, and a large part of that is relationship. I found that one of the best indicators of how a person is going to view immigration policy is if they know any immigrants or not. Now, that's not to say everyone in El Paso, Texas knows immigrants, but most people there, you know some immigrants, and they've also seen some of the challenges of illegal immigration with people entering into the United States illegally, which isn't all of illegal immigration because a lot of people overstay visas as well, but that's a big part of it.
Yes.
So I think what can bring people together is those relationships, though, and especially within the church context. If we can help build bridges between native U.S. citizen believers and those who are of an immigrant background and have let ourselves share stories with one another, I think that's really powerful and helps to recognize, you know, as Christians, we believe that there's one body. 1 Corinthians 12 tells us that there's one body with many members, and that means that if one part of the body suffers, every part suffers. I think what happens too often in the American church is because, as Dr. King said, you know, 50 years ago or so, 11 o'clock on a Sunday is the most segregated hour of the week. So even though there are so many immigrant Christians and increasing numbers of immigrant Christians, especially in evangelical churches, a lot of non-immigrants don't have any of those relationships. So even though the Bible tells us that biblically we're interdependent, that the hand can't say to the foot that I don't need you, we act like we don't need each other. And I think that's part of the problem, and we need to build some of those connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, relationships and stories. And I want to give you an opportunity to give people a little bit of a preview who haven't read your book about what struck me as one of the most interesting sections, and that is when you dealt with biblical motifs, the biblical motifs that can be helpful for Christians seeking to engage in the immigration debate responsibly. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. You know, I was really actually surprised when I started thinking about this issue. I decided I would read through my Bible with this lens on of trying to see where are there immigrants in the scripture, if there were immigrants in the scripture. And I started to realize that immigrants are all over the scriptures, especially in the Old Testament. Most of the characters in the Hebrew scriptures were crossing borders at one time or another. From Abraham all the way through, even Jesus himself was, in one sense, he was in the incarnation, he was a celestial immigrant, leaving the glories of heaven to come live with us on earth. But more practically, he was a refugee who fled to Egypt under a genocide under King Herod. So he has that experience, and you know, we're told that Christ can identify with us. He can identify with those immigrant believers who have had that experience of having to flee and having been displaced. So the scriptures have a lot of immigrants within the story of the narrative of scripture, but God also has a lot to say explicitly about how to treat immigrants, and especially to the people of Israel in the Old Testament law. In Leviticus 19:33 and 34, when an alien lives with you in your land, do not mistreat him. The alien living with you must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So there's this reminder from God to remember our history, to the Israelites to remember their history as people enslaved as foreigners in Egypt. And God tells his people that they need to do better than that. Another theme we have in the Old Testament very often is we find that God links the alien or the immigrant or the sojourner, depending on your translation, with other vulnerable groups, like mm-hmm. the orphan and the widow. So, for example, Psalm 146:9, the Lord watches over the alien and sustains the fatherless and the widow. Or Malachi 3:5, God says, I will be quick to testify against those who defraud laborers of their wages, who oppress the widows and the fatherless, and deprive aliens of justice. And then, of course, in the New Testament, you know, we don't actually have quite as much explicitly about immigrants in the New Testament as in the Old Testament. The Old Testament has 92 references to the Hebrew word ger, which is the word for an alien. In the New Testament, we don't have that quite as much, but we have the idea of loving our neighbor. In Luke 10, when a legal scholar asks Jesus, well, you know, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus tells him to love the Lord your God and to love your neighbor as yourself. And as a legal scholar, I have a background in law myself, and so I hear love your neighbor, and I go immediately to, well, I want to define neighbor. How do you define neighbor? It's the person on either side of me, right? Because that's challenging enough in itself sometimes. But Jesus doesn't give us that out. Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, and that's the story of someone who we don't know much about. You know, this guy, presumably an Israelite on the side of the road, but we can presume he's of a different ethnicity and of a different religion than the Samaritan, and he's in need. And that's pretty much all that we know. We don't know if he did something that he really deserved to get beat up on the side of the road. We don't know if he had broken some other law. All we know is that he's in need. And I think that's really important as an overriding theme. And then, of course, we also have Romans 13 in the New Testament. Romans 13 is the famous passage where Paul tells the church in Rome that they are to submit to the governing authorities because those authorities that have been established by God. And that is an extremely important concept as well. And I think sometimes, you know, Christians want to take one side or the other. They only want to read Romans 13 or they only want to read Leviticus 19. And the reality is we have to hold those things in tension. We are called to submit to the law. For me, though, personally, Romans 13 it doesn't inhibit me from teaching English to my neighbors who don't speak English. It doesn't inhibit me from, you know, sharing the gospel with them because none of those things are illegal at least under the laws of the state of Illinois. For my immigrant brothers and sisters, it is more challenging because they are here unlawfully, either having entered unlawfully or overstayed a visa. And I know a lot of Christians who have really struggled with that. And I know some people who have decided to go back. But I also know some who have said, you know, 1 Timothy 5:8 tells me that if I fail to provide for my immediate family, that I've denied the faith and I'm worse than an unbeliever. And that's exactly why I came here. I could not provide for my family where I was. So, you know, it's a complex issue that I think we should be slow to judge people and quick to hear out their stories and listen. And for me, Romans 13 really makes me want a legal system that does value the rule of law, which I think our current system does not do, because we selectively enforce and ignore the law right and left, both as immigrants violate the law and as employers violate the law by hiring them. Mm-hmm. So I think Romans 13 says to me that we need a functional legal system, and there's no reason that that can't be a system that is more welcoming towards immigrants.
Thank you so much, Matthew Sorens, for being on our show today.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Thanks so much, Don.
And for all our listeners, his book, and there aren't very many out there, and this is a good one. His book is called Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth. This is Don Belenis again with a brief reflection on our conversation with Matthew Sorens about a reasonable approach to the illegal immigration controversy in our nation. As Matthew noted, there aren't many books available which discuss the issues from the Christian perspective. As I hope you could tell from our conversation, his book is both careful and balanced, seeking to properly stress both the rule of law and the need for compassion. So, given multiple scriptural references to the rights and needs of strangers, and at the same time references to the need for justice and order in society, how should we proceed? Well, it's a complicated topic, requiring a lot of expertise that most of us don't have and aren't likely to acquire. But I'm convinced that we should never become extremists in this connection, calling either for harsh measures to remove all undocumented immigrants or insisting on the elimination of legal enforcement. When in doubt, remember Jesus' watchphrase, the commandment that prompted his explanation through the parable of the Good Samaritan. This came just before in Luke 10, verse 25 through 29. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And he, the lawyer, answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Do you and I, like the inquiring lawyer in this passage in the Bible, hope to sidestep the issue and pick and choose our neighbors? I believe one important teaching of this passage is our neighbor is anyone whose life we can influence. And no matter who we're dealing with, the "as yourself" of this commandment is the kicker. It requires us to use our God-given imaginations to honestly step inside the experience of the neighbor. This love our Savior prescribes does not mean excusing everything, any more than we're supposed to excuse ourselves. We need to practice self-discipline, and when we don't, there are consequences. On the other hand, none of us would experience much happiness or success if we'd never been given a break. What's your perspective on the immigration debate? Consider carefully, for Jesus' sake. Our Centered program is a simple production with a big idea: to encourage you to think critically about a wide variety of subjects and to center your everyday life in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our guests are carefully chosen from among people of extraordinary expertise and experience. We don't always agree with them on every point, but we engage in a sensible and respectful dialogue. Today, everyone knows we are living in troubled times. Christians must think and act with the greatest of care. Our prayer is that our Centered program will not only be of serious interest to you, but that it will be a source of useful information. When you tune in, we'd like you to imagine yourself listening in on an interesting conversation between two new friends. We encourage you to contact us and join in the conversation. On behalf of our family and our board of directors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for your kind and thoughtful attention.
Yeah, and check out our website.
Remember, it's www.centeredonline.org.